every story told has a story of its own.
She said the words, I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Every now and then, someone at a place like the grocery store might say something like, I'm glad you're holding MPS accountable. That keeps my fire burning.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now, here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, an in-depth look at the biggest stories from the past week, as well as a deeper dive on stories that deserve a closer examination. I'm Adam Roberts. Thank you, as always, for joining me again on the show. We've got a big one coming up, including a look back at September 11th memorial events held in Milwaukee with WTMJ's Nazir Spencer out on the lakefront this past week. We also have an exclusive conversation with the new head of the Milwaukee streetcar system, better known as the Hop. It's not a hire you may have expected. We talk exclusively with the new head of the system on the show today, and I had the unique opportunity to take a fly along with the 128th Air Refueling Wing on a mission to Nebraska. We'll have all of that coming up on the show today. But we begin with the biggest news of the week, and that was the assassination of conservative activist and Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk. It happened at a university in Utah, Utah Valley University to be specific, during one of Kirk's usual appearances on college campuses where he would engage in debate and conversation with students across the country. The event had already been well underway when a crowd member posed a question to Kirk about gun violence before a single shot rang out, and I will warn you that the audio you will hear is graphic in nature.
Do you know how many mass shooters there have been in America over the last 10 years?
Counting or not counting gang violence?
Great.
The video of the shooting, which had been shared across social media in the immediate moments after Kirk was shot, is incredibly graphic in nature. There had been allegations that some of the videos were being AI enhanced, but any way you shake it, the man was shot in the neck and it became very clear he was not likely to survive. Ultimately, President Trump sharing on Truth Social later in the day that Kirk had indeed died.
It's long past time for all Americans and the media to confront the fact that violence and murder are the tragic consequence of demonizing those with whom you disagree day after day, year after year, in the most hateful and despicable way possible.
The hunt was then on for the gunman. A 22-year-old Utah man was the primary suspect. And after a multi-day search, Utah Governor Spencer Cox broke the news the suspect had been apprehended.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We got him. A family member of Tyler Robinson reached out to a family friend who contacted the Washington County Sheriff's Office with information that Robinson had confessed to them or implied that he had committed the incident.
Kirk's death immediately drew reaction not just from the general public, but from politicians in a year that has already seen other instances of political violence, including with the death of Melissa Hortman, the politician from Minnesota earlier this year. Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley has just recently begun a campaign for governor. We broke that news on WTMJ earlier this week as well. Speaking at a campaign event at Broken Bat Brewery in Milwaukee, Crowley addressed Kirk's assassination at the start of his remarks and also during the media scrum immediately after.
I don't agree with Charlie Kirk on much, but my heart drops. And it's because of the level of political violence and just senseless violence that we're seeing in this country.
I was at the event with Crowley that night and asked him about any possible security detail enhancements that may be coming as a result of Kirk's assassination. He said it was too early to tell what that detail would look like and that he's focused on running the campaign. Other politicians also with sharp reaction to the shooting. Waukesha County Executive Paul Farrell on Wisconsin's Afternoon News.
This is just terrible. To think that we cannot have a political conversation and have political discourse without violence is crazy.
One of my primary takeaways from this past week, in addition to the discourse Charlie's assassination has started, was the reaction to his death from young conservatives. He had generated a massive following across the country in that demographic, so much so he mentioned it when speaking at the Republican National Convention last year in Milwaukee.
I hear a lot from young people about their hopes, their dreams, and their fears. You see, young people are idealists. They respond to vision.
We'll likely learn more in the days and weeks ahead about Tyler Robinson, the 22-year-old suspect now in custody following the assassination of Charlie Kirk, dead at 31 years old. A lot of emotions as well through the coverage you've likely heard over the course of the week, whether it's the Charlie Kirk assassination or, as our next topic is, this past Thursday marked the 24th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, 2001. You likely recall, if you were alive during that time and are old enough to remember, where exactly you were on that day. I was just about to turn 8 years old, sitting in my second grade class at Evans Elementary School in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, when our principal, Mr. Noble, came over the address and mentioned, "Hey everyone, just so you're aware, this has happened. Your teachers likely have it on the mini TVs in the classroom. Know we're monitoring, and also if you have any questions, let us know." And that's about the only thing I remember from that day because, again, I was just about eight. But for many people, even here in southeast Wisconsin, if you're of a certain age, the memories are more vivid, and those memories carry through to the commemoration events that we still do to this day. One of the most powerful is right here in Milwaukee at the War Memorial Center on the lakefront, which has been doing commemoration events every year since 2001. It's a very powerful and somber atmosphere, which I have covered a couple of times since beginning here, and our own Nazir Spencer was covering for us this year. He joins me now on Reporter's Notebook. Nazir, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate having me on.
So walk me through now, because I've, again, covered this event before. So for those who haven't been, describe the scene, the setting, who's there, and what are you seeing and hearing?
So this event was very heartwarming. You know, they had a bunch of they had County Executive David Crowley there. They had Mayor Cavalier Johnson. All of the first responders were there. They had soldiers there doing their, you know, normal routine that they do to remember 9/11. And it was just one of those moments where you kind of just took a step back and you have to remember. That's what everyone does every single year. These ceremonies are very important for that reason. Now, this ceremony, particularly this year, they had a beam from ground zero of 9/11. They drove it on a flatbed from New York all the way here. They got stopped in Indiana, fun fact, and then they got escorted all the way to Wisconsin to make sure that this beam got to the War Memorial, and now it's going to be there at the War Memorial, I believe, for the time being. So it was one of those cool stories. They were able to, you know, show their respects and you know, bring it to Wisconsin.
Unrelated to the emotion of the day, but this year's commemoration was particularly interesting for traffic reasons, because the main bridge on Mason Street that everyone would normally go to just walk right in, that's under construction right now. So just a minor little note about the day. You had to kind of maneuver around, didn't you?
I had to maneuver around a little bit, and there was a little road to the right leading to the art museum, but you couldn't go on that road up to the art museum. You had to go around the back where the parking lot is, and that's exactly where we were stationed to be at. But yeah, it was not too bad.
Nazir, remind me quickly how old you are.
I'm 23 years old.
So if my math is correct, you would have been born either 2002 or 2003.
I was right? 2001. I was 2 months after the event happened, actually. So I was not born yet.
So, but that presents an interesting dynamic here, because I just mentioned that I remember it, but not quite so much. And then there are other people who were well on into their lives and vividly remember. As someone who wasn't even around when this happened, your experience learning about September 11th in school or now covering it in the news,
That's got to be an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I've been, ever since I was younger, I've always wanted to, you know, learn a little bit more about 9/11 and why it happened, who was involved, and, you know, what was the presidency like at the time, what was their message to the public. And I always wanted to learn more. And every year I learned something new about it. And, you know, this is very interesting you say that, because I talked to the chair of the War Memorial, Andy Gordon, and he was telling me after I interviewed him, he was telling me, you know, it's interesting that you're taking such a liking into 9/11, because when I was your age and, you know, I was kind of younger, and Pearl Harbor was a little bit before me, and I wanted to learn more about that as I grew up. And now that the next generation wants to learn more about 9/11, and now this other generation that's coming up after me, they want to learn a little bit more about COVID and, you know, what's going on with that and how people survive through that. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic that everyone has.
Before I let you go, Nazir, you just sparked a thought in my mind. As somebody, you just said you want to go back and learn about why it happened, the who, the what, the where. As someone who regularly is out in the field covering stories, how do you, if you need to, use that dynamic when it comes to telling your stories, when you do your research, for example?
Well, when I do my research, I make sure that I know all of the facts that I can, so I can give the best story possible to give out to the listeners or just the people that are wanting to hear the story happening, because I think that's the most important part about doing your research. You want to be able to tell a great story while also being, you know, right in the middle. You don't want to be on a different side of each story. You want to be right in the middle and tell the story straight up. And I think that's the most important part about, you know, learning all these facts about 9/11 and all the other events in history. You want to learn all the facts and tell it straight up.
WTMJ's Nazir Spencer, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Change in the air for the Milwaukee streetcar system. You know it as the Hop, but outside of the city, most people refer to it just as the Milwaukee streetcar. There is a new operations manager, a new system manager for the system. And I say new. He's been in the position for a few months now, but joining us here on Reporter's Notebook today is James Vigneault, the new streetcar system manager for the city of Milwaukee. James, welcome in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today. I'm very happy to be with you, and I'm very happy to live in Milwaukee for 3 months now.
So let's start there, because you come to the city of Milwaukee with a international background. You've done work in transportation abroad as well as here in the United States, most notably in Doha, Qatar, which we will touch on in a moment. But when you were deciding what's the next career step for me, why Milwaukee?
Milwaukee, I will be frank, I didn't know this city before. Mm-hmm. But when I saw this project, the streetcar here, I have the passion for the public transportation, and I work in transit for more than 20 years. And when I saw this project, I was thinking, oh, that's beautiful here, because that's a nice city, walkable, and it's a big part of the mobility project that they have for this city. And when they advertised for this position, I was thinking that's where I would like to live and to go with them for this, to continue this project.
When did you first set foot in Milwaukee? When was your first experience in the city?
3 months ago.
Okay, so you did admittedly come during a very nice time to see the city. If we're timing that out, that's about June-ish. So beautiful time to visit Milwaukee. Lakefront, you've got festivals going on. Obviously, you will have to deal with some of the cooler months as well, but you are French in background, so winter in France, not uncommon for sure.
Sure, and especially I'm born in Tours, in the Loire Valley, mm-hmm. and we have some episode of snow, but not so hard and cold than here during winter. But I work for a lot of projects in Europe and other places where we have these challenges with the weather. Mm-hmm. And with challenges with visitors, a lot of visitors during summer, which is a great also opportunity for a streetcar project.
So the streetcar system manager position has been vacant for some time, and I know that the city has wanted the next person who takes on this job to be someone with vision for the future of the streetcar system. When you were making your pitch during that interview process, what was your primary objective that you told the hiring committee? Here's what I envision for our streetcar system.
So first, what I'm convinced, we need to have a reliable system, and that's what we are working on it, and that's what the team was working on that in the past. And I strongly believe that it's important for a city to have a system which doesn't create pollution, which is the case for the streetcar. We can improve all the all these projects have a lot of improvement that we can make, and we can also extend. That's why I came here.
So the topic of extension has been a contentious one here in Milwaukee for many years, and there's a lot of different elements at play whenever you talk about expanding any transit system, be it buses, be it trams or streetcars. Even growing an airport has its own unique challenges. What specifically about our system do you see as, I guess, where can we grow? Where should we grow? And how feasible is extension in the short term versus the long term?
So we should go to the south. We should go to the north. I was thinking about the fight serve because that's very, it's the best place where we can go. I would not say tomorrow, but in next years.
Do you believe extension is paramount to the survival of the system as it exists? Because the system we're running right now is basically the starter pack, the 2.1 mile M line loop plus the new L line. That was always planned to be the base blocks for the system and then grow. That growth hasn't happened yet. Is that vital?
Yes, it is. It is. The streetcar is always like a loop, you know, that's to commute inside the city. And to extend, it's great because this is, it makes more sense to have more people, more riders on board, and to serve more community. It's a project that you need to involve, of course, the population, the people living there, but also to make sure that we have a vision for the next 10 or 20 years. And that's the project of the streetcar.
In the past, this system has turned into a political show of gamesmanship on both sides of the aisle. Are you prepared, if necessary, to kind of put that political hat on and work to reach both sides on this and what has been a contentious issue?
Everywhere we have this kind of conversation and this kind of fight sometimes in Europe, in US, of course, and also in other countries where I work with. And that's something that we need to work, to listen, to work with all the communities and to explain how we could be founded and how we can make it the perfect fit for what we need and what the community needs. And we can make it. And I'm ready for that.
So you talked previously about your experience in Doha, Qatar, where you were managing a system that was dealing with 2 million riders on your light rail transit line, or LRT. By comparison, last year, the HOP handled about 530-ish thousand riders over the course of a 12-month window. When you look at your experience with a admittedly much larger line in a place like Doha, what sort of things that worked well there can you transfer then over and apply at a more micro level here in Milwaukee?
I would say first, we have a reach of 3,200,000 riders since the beginning of this project, which is a lot. Of course, US is different than a city in the Middle East, but I can share with you what I did in Doha.
Sure.
There was no streetcar on the project on the smart city, which is much around downtown Doha. And we create completely this streetcar from from scratch. And we make it, and we were ready before the World Cup in Qatar for the FIFA Cup, the soccer game.
So I was going to say, yeah, that times out where you had a mass influx of people that were then riding on this brand new system. Was there local opposition, even despite the fact that you had this massive international event coming and you have to move people around? Was there still that section of people that were like, is this the right allocation of resources?
Of course. And it was more complicated than in a country like the U.S.
James Veneau, the new system streetcar manager, joining us on Reporter's Notebook here on WTMJ. Another angle of the HOP specifically that has come up a lot is this idea of profitability. The system annually costs about $5.7 million to operate, and prior to this past year was receiving a supplement from American Rescue Plan Act funding to help bridge that gap between profit and operating costs. That doesn't exist anymore. What avenues, as you now take on this new position, are you exploring to make that bottom line a little bit more palatable for those at City Hall?
So all the project like this, we need more funds. It could be private, it could be public, but we need to have a vision of the next future of the city. And when you build a streetcar, you always have more value on the buildings. You have more people using the system if the system is reliable. And here we have the chance that it's still free. It's a free system, which shows that the willing of the city and the community here to show that they want a free pollution system in the city.
Do you envision keeping this free or at least making that a priority? Because as it currently exists, as you mentioned, it's free. And I would assume people would like to stay that way.
So far, it's the project that it is built now. Let's see what could be the future. But I think that's a good vision from all the people who were involved in this project to keep it free.
So I did a story a few years ago that did explore this idea of, okay, would you pay, even if it was just a dollar, to ride this system? And the majority of people I had interviewed said, I would, as long as it goes where I want it to go, which is kind of this argument we see. Well, we like the streetcar, those who use it, but I want it to go more. And that, of course, loops back around to this idea of expansion. So if the system hypothetically were to grow and reach these Fiserv forums, the up Farwell and Prospect up the east side, down towards Walker's Point, would then you potentially explore this idea of, okay, we're now growing past our initial block project. Now maybe we should start charging.
That's not the project that I heard until now. I think keeping this project free, it's a good idea. And it's not free because we charge, you know, it costs. So it's a charge for the city. But it's a willing from the city to keep something which is reliable and which is useful for the community.
Another thing that's been explored is the idea of long-term maintenance as well. We do see from time to time the system will have to shut down or suspend temporarily operations due to whether it's switch issues or other mechanical issues. Where can we grow in terms of keeping our streetcar running at an optimal level?
This streetcar doesn't have dedicated lines. You know, that's one of the issue that we have here. But maybe the next step should be different. But right now, we share the traffic with the cars, so we have a lot of situations that we could be blocked for a short time. Regarding the switch and all this kind of mechanical issue that we have, this has to be fixed by the service provider that we have hired since the beginning. It's the same service provider that they do this job, and they work on it, and they need to fix the problem when this happens. It's not complicated. It's just to make sure that we analyze very well the root cause of the breakdown when it happened. But again, since I'm here, I see a very huge improvement of the reliability of the fleet. And that's great because we have five cars and we need to run with these five cars.
James, before I let you go, one last question. Clearly, you are somebody over the course of your career who has developed and had coming in a passion for this. You don't go this far into doing what you're doing if you aren't truly passionate about this idea of getting people from point A to point B and doing it efficiently. What drives you to continue doing what you do, and how will you use that drive to grow our public transit in a city like Milwaukee that everyone always says, we're on the rise. What will get us into that next step?
So for me, you know, I have the passion for the public transportation since I'm born. You know, I was always in the suburbs and using public transportation because we were from a poor family. And I know how it is important to have a system reliable. And I use transportation. I used here also in Milwaukee. So I can tell you where our weakness are and where we can do improvements. And we do a lot. In a few weeks, I see a lot of change. That's great, and we need to continue to do that, and that's very important, that never give up. This is my belief, never give up when we have a project like this.
James Veneau, the new system manager for the Milwaukee streetcar, with me on Reporter's Notebook. James, thank you very much.
Thank you, Adams.
Big happenings at the 128th Air Refueling Wing this weekend. An open house being held at the wing for the first time since 2012. Visitors are going to be able to see all the big jets. They call it lovingly Pet a Jet at the refueling wing. You'll have jets like the KC-135 Stratotanker, the C-17 Globemaster III jet. Some F-35s are going to be there as well. A lot of different things to see and touch. I was able to experience beforehand not just seeing and touching one of these jets, but flying along in one. I got to fly along this past Friday in the 128th KC-135 Stratotanker as it completed a refueling mission over the skies of Nebraska, 26,000 feet above the plains, for that C-17 Globemaster tailing behind it back to Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport. The fly-along presented some interesting challenges in telling a story. From the audio perspective, anything once we took off from the ground was basically unusable, because if you've never been on a military jet, there's a lot of noise in the cabin as well as in the cockpit. More on that in a moment. But it's just very loud, so even the best audio recording equipment isn't going to be much good. And also, by the way, these people aboard the plane are doing their jobs and aren't exactly keen on stopping for a 10-minute interview while, oh, by the way, you're sending a boom down to a C-17 flying just below you while you're also flying hundreds of miles an hour, 26,000 feet above the ground. That being said, I was able to have a very brief conversation with the two pilots of a KC-46 jet that had just flown into the 128th all the way from New Hampshire on its own mission.
So you guys flew in from New Hampshire. This is the KC-46, correct?
That's correct.
So we'll be flying on a 135 later today. Are there any similar, what's the biggest similarity and difference, would you say, to those two craft?
The similarity is our mission set. We're both air refueling platforms, but the biggest difference is just the build time. You know, sure. The 135, first built in the 50s. Some of these models here, we're flying that's a 62 model, that's a 71 model, or sorry, a 67 model. And this one here was built in 2018, so.
2018.
Yeah.
And I gotta ask, so we're in tight quarters back here. This is probably not a field for someone over like 6'6", I would say.
No, they make it work. They make it work. I'm 6'1", I do all right. But there's some tall pilots out there. Tell the recruiter to make it happen.
Fair enough. All right, thanks so much,
yeah,
guys.
Thank you.
And from there, I was shuttled aboard the KC-135 and sent off to Nebraska. One of the interesting things about all the planes at the 128th that you'll be able to see if you check out the open house is the artwork that's on the vertical stabilizer, so the very back end of the plane that kind of sticks straight up into the air. The planes at the 128th have their own unique artwork, and you see this in military planes across the country, but specifically at the 128th, they have a lot of local connection. I spoke with Captain Charles Merkel about the work they just completed on the plane we were flying that day.
The background on that is that artwork goes back to at least 1963. And, you know, it's a flying tanker with a boom coming out of it, you know, refueling probe coming out of it. And we thought it would be a nice piece of history and a little esprit de corps to get that painted on one of our tails. So a lot of the wings will have a wing jet, you know, with a special paint job. So we started that process over a year ago, threw up the artwork and got it approved, and then just finished it about 2 months ago.
Yeah.
So it's got the Stein, the flying Stein on the tail, and then the stripe in the middle of the jet is from the Strategic Air Command days when SAC no longer exists, but that was kind of a throwback to our heritage there as well.
Big thanks to everyone at the 128th, by the way. Very consummate professionals, all the way from the briefing in the media room beforehand to walking around and checking out some of the planes before we ended up taking off, all the way through the air, immediately landing as well. It was just an excellent experience. Love the people at the 128th. I will say, another interesting wrinkle in telling the story, and if you visit my Twitter at AdamRobertsMKE, also on Blue Sky, you can see some of the images I was able to capture from inside the boom operator pit, where the operator is shooting down the boom towards the jet below us. it's pretty tight quarters in there and is not always the easiest to get photos. You have to kind of wiggle around and work some different angles, but was really happy with how those images turned out. So if you want to check them out for yourself, you can either view, again, my socials at AdamRobertsMKE. We also have a web story that we'll have attached to the online version of Reporter's Notebook. You can check that out at WTMJ.com. And by the way, even if you missed an opportunity to get out to the open house, this was the first one, again, that they were doing since 2012. But I have a funny feeling that they will be doing it again because planes are pretty popular in Milwaukee. Mitchell International, how is that parking lot off of, I believe it's College Avenue, where you can just sit and watch planes take off and land at the airport. So I have a funny feeling that the open house will be back again soon.